The material in this podcast is for information purposes only. It does not represent the opinions of Vested Finance and is not intended to be investment advice. We recommend you to consult with a financial advisor before committing to any financial decisions.
I have the pleasure to be interviewing Pankaj Naik today, the Executive Director and Co-Head of the Digital and Technology Practice at Avendus. Avendus is the leading investment bank for technology deals in India. They have advised tech companies such as Lenskart, Swiggy, Nika, BookMyShow, Policy Bazaar, Ola, Akko, Zenoti, Metal, and many more. Pankaj is a seasoned banker with more than 20 years of banking experience. Prior to Avendus, Pankaj worked with JP Morgan and Merrill Lynch. He holds an MBA degree from IIM Calcutta. Today's conversation will be around two things. Number one, the rising D2C trend in India. And number two, the capital funding environment for startups in India around COVID and the degrading relationship between India and China. Without further delay, let's dive into our conversation with Pankaj. Thanks for joining us today, Pankaj. We really appreciate you being here.
Thanks for having me, David.
You and your team at Avendus just released this great study on the rising trend of D2C, direct-to-consumer in India, which we will link on the share notes, the link to the reports. But for our listeners, D2C is an e-commerce approach where businesses or brands sell directly to end consumers via e-commerce sites, bypassing retailers such as supermarket malls, Kirana stores. So in the report, you outlined the strong momentum in this space, which is poised to grow to 100 billion by 2025. Can you talk more about why this is happening?
Sure, Darwin. D2C brands are at a juncture where they will see a tremendous secular growth in India, in our view. And there are three main reasons for this happening. First, lack of organized retail penetration that is leading to leapfrogging directly to online brand consumption. At $39 billion, e-tail is just 4% of the total retail market compared to China's 30%. Second, this is a brand-starved country. The customer is unsatiated, starved for brands, variety, and wanting to have a very personal connect with the brands. And especially the millennial want to kind of try out new brands and want to have a personal connect. And these traditional brands, which have been there for a long time, have not been able to easily adapt to the newer consumers. They are still selling it through the traditional way. They're not adapting to the new digital ecosystem. And the third, which is very robust, supporting digital ecosystem, faster time to market, ability to test the product quickly in the market, also deeper understanding of the consumer due to data, the social media, and finally, the marketplaces, right? You know, you have Amazon, you have Flipkart, and also have express logistics, you know, with people like Delivery, ExpressBees, and then the omni-channel capabilities that are helping the D2C brand grow very quickly.
Interesting. So it's kind of like a secondary effect of more people spending more time digitally. Of the different industry being pursued by D2C companies, which sector do you think works best with the D2C approach? What qualities must the business have to fit well with the direct-to-consumer model?
For any digital brand to be successful, there are a few things that need to fall in place, especially because you need to spend money acquiring the consumer, Google, Facebook, or if you're going on Amazon or Flipkart or Nika, you know, you probably have to pay the commissions to the marketplaces. So there has to be enough money in the margin stack for the D2C brand to work. That's why the first and the most important is your average order value has to be right. You probably, you know, 150, 200 rupee things are a little difficult to make money. Second is customer repeat, which is true about largely a lot of online businesses. But if you ended up acquiring a consumer, you want that consumer to stay with you. If your product is good, the consumer has to come back to you. And that's why the product that you're selling has to have a reasonable repeat use. For example, beauty and care, shampoo or cosmetic product, where people actually come back and buy in a month's time, in a 2 months' time. So there is a reasonable frequency of repeat. If there is a food item, then people order it very regularly. Customer repeat is important. Third thing is, if you're selling a branded product, then you're expected to have a good gross margin. But there has to be reasonably high gross margin. Otherwise, you won't have much room to play for customer acquisition cost or logistics cost of delivery of these products. So these are the three things which are important. And that's why I believe these three industries, which we have also highlighted in our report, which is beauty and care, food and apparel, in that order, they're probably most suitable for D2C.
In the report, you also highlighted that in the traditional model, typically the brand spends about 20 to 30% of the revenue on distributor and retailers. While it is true that in the D2C model, you do not have distributor nor retailers, these middlemen are instead replaced with online marketplaces, as you mentioned, Amazon, Flipkart, and online advertising, Facebook and Google instead. So these D2C brands still spend about 22, 32% on these new digital middlemen?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And Darwin, we have to understand that I don't think anybody is saying that D2C brands will have necessarily a higher EBITDA or net profit margins compared to physical offline brands. What this whole phenomenon does, it gives a chance for newer brands to actually succeed and scale up vis-a-vis the incumbents. You will have to spend money either on CAC or you have to spend money on marketplace commissions till you become very large. There are pros and cons of both of them. If you spend money on CAC, but you get a lot of data of the consumer and you know what exactly works for the consumer. If you decide to go on marketplaces, you will grow much faster, but how much data on the consumer you will be able to get from the marketplaces is a question mark. So there are pros and cons. But your ability to establish a brand and build it quickly to scale is only possible because of the direct-to-consumer and digital channel these days. And if you look at how many physical distribution-style brands have evolved in last 10 or 20 years, competing with Unilever's and Procter & Gamble's or the Godrej's or Dabur's of the world, not many actually. This whole new distribution channel gives a chance for people to come and build like a 500 crore brand, a 1,000 crore brand in relatively less time. All these brands over a period of time, in our view, will either go towards different distribution channels. One, their own, B, the marketplaces like Amazon, Flipkart, Nykaa, and three, they will go omnichannel. Because at any point in time, if you're growing rapidly, you would want to make sure that you use your marketing engine to make people aware of the brand. At the same time, if people want that brand, you want that brand to be available at various channels. And if you look at Mama Earth or Sugar or Health Cart, some of these guys are already doing that. Or for example, even folks like Licious, even though they are growing rapidly online, they have a strategy to actually start offline presence as well.
I see. In a way, it's kind of when they started, they need to circumvent the advantage that the incumbent has, where they control the shelf space in physical retail, right? But then through digital channels, their D2C companies establish their brand, establish their presence, and then eventually kind of muscle into a whole omni-channel strategy, which kind of leads to my next question. In the US, the D2C space is a little bit more mature. And what we've seen is there's kind of two paths of evolution of the early D2C companies. The first is, with digital-only strategies, their CAC increases over time. And then they eventually, as you mentioned, kind of expand into physical retail, either by opening their own stores in malls or by partnering with big box stores. You see this with Warby Parker. You see this with Casper, which is a mattress company who just went public, I think, last year, and others. Yeah. Or you get acquired by the incumbents. You see this with a lot of the healthcare, the Razorbait, Harry's and Dollar Shave Club of the world. So I guess my question is, fast forward 5 or so years, how do you see the space evolve in India? Any learnings from the Chinese ecosystem that we can apply here?
This is, again, very appropriate question and very relevant, because most of the companies in India who started in D2C actually learned very quickly from, if I want to say, mistakes of the Western world. They are not purely focused on quote-unquote Puritan approach that I will only sell on my platform, because they realize that if you start spending ton of money on acquiring consumer, and if I don't make a lot of money on them, basically I'll keep on losing a ton of money without getting too much of returns. A lot of these people actually immediately started selling on platforms, and very early in their evolution, they also started experimenting with omnichannel. in my sense, in maybe because the availability of capital in this particular space has been a little scarce earlier, obviously there is a lot of interest now, people have been very disciplined about how they are growing their businesses. Actually, in terms of profitability, they are far ahead compared to traditional otherwise e-commerce businesses that you would see in this country. I believe that if you look at the M&A action, we believe that there are two types of M&A actions will happen in our country as well. One is incumbents will end up buying some of these companies purely because incumbents will realize that these companies are growing fast and becoming larger and becoming threat to them. And even if a lot of people think that we can do it ourselves, people realize after one or two tries that this the digital DNA is not very easy to build in a large organizations. The second type of M&A I would see is actually the adjacencies, the roll-up strategy. The market leaders will actually, to grow into adjacencies, to build brands under one umbrella brand, will actually acquire newer brands and grow their businesses before they go for an IPO, or even after they go for an IPO, they'll continue to have a reasonable roll-up strategy. And so the companies in India will grow both organically and inorganically. We believe that at least 4 or 5 unicorns in the next 3 or 4 years, and probably 5 or 6 IPOs also in the next 3 or 4 years. I also expect at least 4 or 5 M&A transactions in the next couple of years as well.
I guess shifting gears to the funding ecosystem, there has been 2 seismic events in the Indian funding landscape in 2020 alone. The first is in April, the government instituted a policy requiring official approval for any investments from a country that shares a land border with India. But it specifically really targets the foreign direct investment from China. And then number 2, COVID-19 and the ensuing lockdown. Can we talk about the impact of one? As some of the largest startups in India are funded by Chinese tech giants, Zomato by Ant Financials, Swiggy by Tencent. In fact, I believe it's more than 60% of India's 30 unicorns are funded by either big Chinese technology groups or venture capital funds.
Yeah, we all were a little concerned about how this is going to pan out. But I think one thing that you need to look at it, like when you say that, you know, some of these companies are funded by Chinese investors, mm-hmm. you have to see whether they're funded only by Chinese investors or Chinese investors are part of the cap table. Apart from few where Chinese investors dominate the cap table, I think the rest of the companies, for example, if you take Swiggy or some of the others, Chinese investors are there, but they're not dominant. It's not that the growth and the survival and the next stage of growth is dependent only on Chinese investors. That is one point. The second point is, if you just look at what happened in the last 6 months, the American and the Asian investors have become very aggressive. And some of the new investors were like pension funds and the sovereign funds. And some of the crossover investors, the people who actually usually invest in IPOs, but for good quality large companies, they don't mind taking large private stakes. All these guys are active. We have done 10 deals post-lockdown. We didn't feel a problem because in spite of interest, some of our really partner-oriented Chinese either corporates or funds couldn't invest into some of the companies that we are taking to the market. But at the same time, there were other investors who were ready to actually come and invest into those companies at pretty attractive valuation. And that trend is continuing. If you just look at the amount of funding that is happening in good quality companies, I don't think that there is any dearth of capital for growth of these companies. One more thing, actually. Even some of the private equity guys also are taking technology bets, which earlier we thought that this is something difficult for them to invest in because the traditional matrices don't work for them. But we've done deals in, say, for example, companies like Dream 11 or Lenskart, where there are the non-tech investors or traditional private equity investors are actually have invested in these companies as well.
I see. Interesting. Which kind of leads me to my follow-up question. At least in the US, the early days of the global lockdown in March and April, we saw high uncertainties in the startup funding situation. But as we entered the summer, investors seems to gain more comfort in meetings and writing checks over Zoom calls. Can you share what you've seen in the India ecosystem? You mentioned you've kind of completed 10 deals in the past 8-10 months or so since COVID began.
Yeah, again, I'll divide it into brackets, the seed in series A and then B, C, D, E, F, G, whatever the larger ones. I think seed series A, people actually are giving term sheets without meeting founders as well. That's what I hear, at least from the people that we know in the ecosystem. Because your check sizes are $1 million, $2 million, which is not something that you're worried about. I think series C onwards, when I get 30 million, 20 million check or 100 million plus check, I think sometimes investors would want to at least have one meeting with the founders. Most of the deals that we have done have had some prior connect as well. It's not that people had never met the founder even once. I don't think that was the case in the deals that we have closed. And some of the deals that we are doing right now, few of them will have probably the total deal happening over just the Zoom calls. And I was speaking to some of the ecosystem partners, the venture capital investors. It's a mixed bag. There's some people say, okay, unless I meet the founder, I can't do this. But there are people who've done $20, $30 million deals without meeting people face-to-face.
I guess I want to be cognizant of your time here. So one final question, as a closing, any parting advice for startup founders in terms of raising funds, especially during these uncertain times?
Sure. So COVID-19 kind of was a wake-up call for a lot of founders. The reason is some people who would actually just raise capital before COVID-19 hit, they're obviously in reasonably good position. Some people were thinking of going to the market in the next 1 or 2 months were hit really badly. That kind of makes people realize that you need to have enough capital and enough cushion. We generally say the rule of thumb is that you have to have at least 18 months of capital before you go to the market for the next raise. Ideally 2 years, but at least 18 months. If you don't think the valuation is right, that's why you want to postpone your decision of raising capital, etc. Always remember that actually having something is better than eventually having nothing. You should be cognizant and always be safe. And the other thing that we also realize that even in the tech ecosystem, you should keep your options open, because if you go a long way with an investor and eventually he reneges on the term sheet or something, sets you back by 3 to 6 months and you start all over again. If you have a choice, then try and see if you can actually keep your options open, because otherwise things have worked out pretty bad for people who actually, after 3-5 months of negotiation, the investor walks away and you had like 4 or 5 people before who were interested. And after that, you know, it's just taken a toll on your business. And then you start all over again and you end up achieving a suboptimal outcome.
Have you seen the time to close funding rounds extended during this period?
No. Pretty much similar.
I see. Well, thank you, Pankaj. If folks wants to follow you and read more about your work, how can they do that?
Sure. So we keep publishing our work on Avendus.com, which is our company's website. I'm also on Twitter, and my handle is Pankaj R. Naik, PankajRNaik. And I'm also on LinkedIn, where we keep publishing some of the work that we do.
Great. We'll post that on the show notes as well. Thanks again, Pankaj. You must come back when you publish another report.
Absolutely. Would love to.